going to call this meeting of the House Interim Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness to order. And we'll start with our informational part of our meeting first. And so we're going to have a couple of presentations and discussions of a couple of measures that we talked about as potentially as committee bills. And then once we've had that conversation, we'll move on to some other issues. And we may, after that particular conversation, we may go ahead and go into a work session and just move those committee bills, and then that part will be done, but we'll see then. So we'll start off with, so Representative Huffman isn't here.
It's the usual suspects.
You know if he's coming?
I thought he was.
Can we, why don't we start with LC 176, if that's all right, Representative Evans?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So just for the record, make sure we introduce ourselves and name and...
Thank you, Chair Lively, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paul Evans, a state representative, House District 20. I live at 744 Main Street East in the metropolis of Monmouth, Oregon. And I'm going to let my partners in crime here introduce themselves.
I'm Steve Anderson, working with Representative Evans on the bill. I live in Polk County at 3240 Geller Road Northwest in Salem, Oregon.
I am Kristen Dennis. I am the Policy Director in the Oregon State Treasury.
Oh, very good. Thanks a lot for being here.
So thank you for this opportunity for us to present what we hope will be a committee bill. I wanted to bring the two folks up with me today to really introduce you to them, and if the committee decides to move this as a committee bill or accept it as a committee bill. Steve Anderson is a member of CERT, Community Emergency Response Team in training. He is also the co-chair of the West Salem Neighborhood Association. He's a longtime person who's been involved in making public policy at many different levels of government, and he is actually a volunteer and a helper on this particular project. Very knowledgeable, and I think going to be very helpful to bring things together. We also have the Department of the Treasury involved in this process. One of the things from last session, we had a number of ideas, and out of those conversations, this was became something that the Treasury was very interested in working on. In fact, as I mentioned the last time we were together, originally we were going to try to bring this bill in 2017, but Laura Lockwood McCall and her team suggested that there was an opportunity that we just probably didn't want to miss, and that's why we're bringing it forward right now. So that's kind of the brief history, and what I'd like to do is outline the concept real quick and then provide any answers that you might have to some questions. The legislative concept 176 offered for consideration is a bill that is in many ways a mechanism mirroring the positive aspects of a long-established federal program, the Urban Area Security Initiative Grant Program. And what it does is UASI uses the federal purchase power, federal coordination abilities to provide metro areas with assets and equipment and other types of materials that might otherwise be difficult for the cities to justify to an ever-focused budget appetite. Using that as a lesson, we recognize that wouldn't it be nice if we used existing bonding authority that couldn't be used because of a number of factors, people not being shovel-ready, et cetera, but of the money that was set aside to be used for capital expenditures, wouldn't it be interesting if we could actually use some of that to provide added capacity pre-event so that in the case of a catastrophic disaster, instead of wishing we could have gotten equipment out to some of the targeted areas, we would actually be able to say we had gotten equipment out there to targeted areas. More importantly, unlike some of the cachet programs that work where equipment is put in warehouses pre-staged, what if we could actually make sure that the equipment was not just there but actually functional? And putting those together, we suggested that we knew that there were local and regional interests throughout the areas that would be most impacted by seismic or tsunami or other types of disasters, and that in many cases those local and regional public safety and public service agencies don't have the budgetary capacity to purchase some of the things that they wish they had. So what is before you is not perfect, but hopefully close. It is a plan to use funds that couldn't be used to purchase equipment in an orderly, rational way. Oregon Homeland Security Council would set priorities. OEM would be doing the oversight. The idea is that five or six, maybe as many as 10 items total, but no more than that, would be determined, and then the state could use its purchase capabilities to standardize the type of equipment and purchase those equipment, and then local and regional agencies could put in for a grant to use that equipment on a long-term use. So theoretically, a 10-year lease, with the idea that what the locals are putting into it is the maintenance, upkeep, and training to operate the equipment. What the state gets out of it is, if there's a disaster, that we need that equipment, it will be moved to where it needs to be, and we know it's turnkey, ready to go. What the locals get out of it is they get to use it as often as they need to for their 24/7 responsibilities, and it's, I think, a pretty good partnership that would optimize the bonding authority of the state. That's the program in a nutshell. Are there any major questions?
What questions do members have? Any questions? Yes, Representative Escobar.
Give me kind of a rundown, Representative, if you would, of what kind of equipment we're talking about. You're talking about wheel loaders, you're talking about backhoes, you're talking about graders, you're talking about generators. What exactly are we talking about?
Chair Lively, Vice Chair Escobar, I'm not on the Oregon Homeland Security Council, so I can't tell you what it would be. I can tell you what I hope it will be. Includes such items as generators, rescue boats, or at least the inflatable rescue boat, perhaps in certain areas what we would call a vehicle ferry, because if the bridges come down, it'd be awful nice to actually have some ferries along the Willamette that could get goods and services across. Certainly generators, certainly potentially federal surplus that is still in good shape. We have a lot of generators coming back from the Middle East. Many of them aren't usable, but many of them might be. And the goal is to have a interoperable purchase where we say, all right, these things are generally useful for both catastrophic events as well as 24/7 needs for life, safety, and property, like a generator, for example. But instead of allowing folks or directing folks to go and find the best thing they can find, where you end up with many different kinds of generators, many different kinds of equipment, the standardization piece that this program would implement would actually I think be an aid both short-term and long-term. So I don't know exactly what they would be on that list, but the kinds of things that are force multipliers for life safety, certainly, the kinds of things that would be prioritized probably would be the things that after an event, that first 72 hours, that first 84 hours, we know we're going to need a lot of, and things that are mobile. Because this isn't really a program to put things into place that can't be moved. It's the ability to have equipment close to where we think we're going to need it when the big one comes, and movable from there.
Paul, sure, go ahead.
On the, you mentioned military surplus. I've noticed with military surplus, though, it depends upon what year you buy it is what they have. Mm-hmm. And you can't hardly standardize those very easily, because one model will be completely different than the other model. But what would you do on these things for an EMP?
Chair Lively, Vice Chair.
I mean, that would take them out.
Chair Lively, Vice Chair Escobar, electronic magnetic pulse? I don't know. I don't know. I hope we would find redundant systems. But I don't have an answer for that.
It would have to be every emergency comes to my mind.
Maybe everyone but that one. Yes, sir.
Well, I think there's ways you can protect them. Anyway.
I'm sure there's some type of shielding, but I would be lying if I told you I knew.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? So, Representative Evans, help me understand again. So when we're talking about who would be eligible to have this equipment, it would be the state, it could be counties, could be cities, could be any level of government?
Chair Lively, members of the committee. Yes, sir. And there was a little bit of confusion on this, but the most recent draft that you should have tried to clarify that just a little bit. Though state agencies certainly could put a grant in to use it, mm-hmm. It's really intended mostly for local, county, regionals. It was intended, although this is certainly a policy choice, to include nonprofits and private entities with a FEMA emergency support function requirement. So not just a private company that wants to borrow a van, but rather if there are folks that are doing public service through contract or whatever, that are especially serving vulnerable populations that they have a responsibility to be able to have evacuation plans for, et cetera, they would be potentially eligible. But again, Oregon Homeland Security Council would set the priorities, the boundaries on who could and who couldn't. And this program is really trying to emphasize state ownership of the equipment so that, for example, if a local or regional entity that wants to borrow our generator, for example, in the grant process, they'd have to showcase that they have someone trained to operate it, that they'll maintain it. If they don't maintain that, then it can be taken back and re-rolled somewhere else. So it's not bought by the local entity. It's a state item. But it will provide the folks out there that just can't afford to buy some of the things they need access to tools that might save lives.
And what happens after 10 years?
The idea right now, again, policy choice, but the idea right now is that at the end of 10 years or depreciation, when it's no longer of a real market value, that the entity that's been using it has first choice to purchase, and if not, then it's re-rolled to another user.
And what, so, and I appreciate these are all things to be working on, but so my concern becomes once we've made this investment and it's there and it reaches some useful life,
yes,
that won't mean that we don't still have the need, but so would the intent be that somehow this program will continue to perpetuate, I guess, over time, so eventually we can replace that equipment?
Chair Lively, members of the committee, I think right now the need is so great that for the first several cycles it will simply be populating. But my hope, quite frankly, is if this works, because again, this is a pilot program, if it works, it could be a standard where every biennium where there is unused bonding authority, we know we put it into optimizing it for equipment purchases that, again, meet the local and regional emergency plans and identified needs. We want to make sure we don't make it too easy for folks who don't really need something. On the other hand, the locals are out there trying to make it work every day, and if it's in their plans and they've identified it as a need, I'd like to help them get it.
Okay. And I have one more question, so I should know this, but so who is the Oregon Homeland Security Council?
Chair Lively, members of the committee, by statute, the Oregon Homeland Security Council is an advisory council to the governor.
Okay.
Several years back, it was populated and relatively active, especially around the 2007-2008 disaster on the Northwest Coast.
Mm-hmm.
By statute, it's there's been many proposals over the years to make it bigger, smaller, et cetera, but it does still exist.
Okay.
It includes legislative involvement as well as senior agency directors.
Okay.
My hope is in the future to perhaps extend that just a little bit to include some of the local emergency management folks as well as local interests. But it seemed like the best all-purpose, all-hazard, all-government approach to setting policy of this magnitude.
Okay. Yes.
One question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Representative, what kind of bonds are we talking about? A GO bond or a revenue bond?
Chair Lively, Vice Chair Esquivel.
And who pays it?
Article Q bonds is what we're looking for, and I'm going to let Treasury explain that.
I figured you'd let the lady that knew.
Sure, yes, they, Chair Lively, Vice Chair Esquivel, the Q bonds, which allows for, which we'd be able to use because it's property that would be owned by the state. So it would have to, there would not be revenue bonds.
So it's a general obligation bond. That's what it is.
Any other questions? Okay. Thanks a lot. We look forward to.
Thank you, Chair.
For the discussions.
Thank you, Chair Lively. Again, if the committee accepts the bill, Steve will be the point person on this, and we'll make sure you have access to his contact information and everything around that.
Because we'll have a lot to do in a short period of time if we're going.
Yes, sir.
So if we have follow up questions, Representative, on bonds, but we don't talk to you.
I know their phone numbers, but these are the smart ones.
I don't blame you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you,
sir. Representative Huffman, welcome.
Apologies in another hearing that went long. I'm sorry I missed this. Does it create a task force, or what are we doing?
We could add that. See, we have the opportunity yet.
It's the Evans touch.
We haven't made a lot of progress, have we? Okay, so that takes care of LC-176. Your timing's impeccable. So now we're going to talk about LC-57. That you and Representative Evans are going to provide. So you're pointing to Representative Evans.
Why did you leave down there?
You can stay up here if you want to. It's up to you.
Mr. Chair, I'm just going to say what he said. He agreed to take point.
I can't assure you that members may not have some pretty in-depth questions for you if you say that, but you can take your chances. Okay, Representative Evans, since he's deferred to you.
Yes, sir. Chair Lively, members of the committee, thank you again for the opportunity to talk. I was trying to figure out how to explain where we're at on LC 57. I was reminded of what Winston Churchill said one time, that the British nation and the United States were two great civilizations separated by a common language. And I say that because the unfortunate truth is, in this particular case, a miscommunication is the result of not being able to provide a bill for today's consideration. Having said that, what I'd like to do in just a few minutes is explain what Representative Huffman and I attempted to do, the outlook, the outline, and potential next steps if the committee is amenable to that. First is, for those that are just tuning in, veterans' preference is one of those measures that is a powerful tool for helping veterans reintegrate into society by having access to an opportunity to get a job. It's an opportunity that this state has made a commitment to, and in fact, a couple of commitments to. They've revised the statute a couple of times, which is really how we're where we're at right now. Over the last several years, public agency employers have implemented a number of different efforts to try and, from their perspective, keep faith with that hiring preference process, and some have been more effective than others. And the thought, after a year, there was a work group that formed Senate Bill 87 that went into last legislative session that would have been potentially acceptable to some but loved by none. And what Representative Huffman and I tried to do over the summer was look at the aspects that really made sense for just good policy. The idea is, if in doubt, do what's right and figure out the politics later. We recognize that all advocates involved have legitimate concerns, but we really focused on three main needs when we look at this piece of legislation. First is, there needs to be clarity and simplicity in terms of implementation. And we realize that thanks to a number of folks, including one that's in the audience today, Colonel Rydell, that Department of Administrative Services actually has the best process by which veterans' preference for hiring and veterans' preference for promotions. So far, it has survived the court tests, where some other efforts have not survived court tests. And the idea is, if we're going to have one policy, make it simple, clear, and universal. That was supposed to be in the bill. There was a miscommunication. The bill as it is right now does not show that. That's part of the reason I'm asking us to defer and measure two or three times before we cut on this one, to make sure we get it right. The other aspects of it were that there is some people call it an escape clause currently in there. It's a discretionary authority that in most cases hasn't really resulted in a problem, but in some unique cases has resulted in some agencies perhaps not fulfilling the intent or the spirit of the veterans preference process, which is of a concern. Ironically, one of the greatest offenders was actually the state of Oregon at a senior leadership level, and we're working to hunt that down as it is. Mm-hmm. The other piece that was really important is, what is the function of the bill? Is the function of the bill to help every veteran every time, or was the function of the bill originally, because having to do with employment, centered around the frustrations of veterans that have enlisted performance reports, officer performance reports, military language that is in their work history that really isn't understood by the civilian world? And there was a need and a concern by some public employers that if it's open to every veteran in every circumstance, that's just too big of a number to manage. And while I really don't think that that is a major concern, what the end result that made sense to Representative Huffman and I were to look at the federal government for models. And what we looked at was the GI Bill in terms of its 10-year limit. Mm-hmm. And the idea is, if in fact this is a bill to try to help reintegrate veterans into the workforce, especially those that are just coming out and have a hard-to-explain background because of the nature of the military, that a 10-year limit would be acceptable if there was no escape clause and if there was a universal application of the DAS standards, and if in those cases where folks were not able to meet the requirements for interviews or for hiring, there was a written explanation of what they needed to do different. So it was a teaching process. Those were the major components of what we felt was good policy. I'm not going to tell you that everybody loved it. In fact, the only thing I know is everybody seems to not like the solution, which makes me think it's probably pretty close to where it needs to be. But until we have the language to actually showcase, my recommendation, and I think it's Representative Huffman's as well, is we continue to ask Department of Administrative Services to work with Legislative Council on getting the language that they need. So it's the similar process that we know has been tested by the courts, and that we then put that draft in front of the advocates and actually have a conversation about where we can make it work. Does that cover the span of what we talked about?
Sounds good.
That's all you're going to say?
Yes.
Thanks for those enlightening words, Representative Huffman.
Do members have any questions? Yes.
You know, we've gone through this I don't know how many times, but I've been on this committee for quite some time, and John and I have been on it forever, it seems like. But haven't we had this in front of us numerous times? And we had something that we thought was pretty simple before, except there's one big city in the state of Oregon that can't seem to get their act together and understand it because they don't want to understand it. Same with some of the departments we have. We have people that understand this. They just don't want to adhere to it. And I think that's wrong. And I think there should be some form of disciplinary action on the people in the state. And there should be some penance toward the people that won't adhere to it that said, I don't understand it. It's amazing how the rest of the state can understand it.
Representative Huffman, you have a...
I do agree. I think we're headed in the right direction. If we can get model policy that's apparently been working and holds the court test, and it's understandable, and I think we'll end up with something that we have been working on for many biennia that hopefully will really work.
So model policy I heard, and I want y'all to correct me if I'm wrong, is that you're modeling that off of the GI Bill, because the federal government, to my knowledge, gives you veterans preference points for hiring, but does not do what Oregon took the additional step of doing the interview thing. So I don't think that's an apples-to-apples comparison of, because that's, 10 years to use it or lose it for schools, but even then they changed that, right, with the post-9/11 GI Bill. So, because my kids can use that for a long time way after 10 years after Mark's separated. My kids aren't, I wish they were in college right now. But that's just not happening. So I don't necessarily consider that an apples-to-apples comparison of way the federal government has asked to implement a veteran's benefit. If you have a disability claim, you can go use that till mm-hmm. you go make the claim. So I don't want to necessarily conflate those things in a step where Oregon has moved us further than the federal government allows on a veteran's hiring preference and try to put some limitations on it that way. So I still have concerns. I still have concerns about the political concerns. I don't need to rehash, ban the box or, but remember, people brought this because they were upset about we created a right of action, and those same people came back and did not blink about creating a different kind of right of action. So I still am not interested in
Mr. Chair,
thank you.
Moving that forward, I'm going to put those on the record again.
Thank you.
I think we're looking at an Oregon state model that's worked, not a federal model that's worked. The GI Bill part was how long does the state as an employer have to look back? If I took training 35 years ago, is that applicable today?
And if I could, Chair.
Sure.
Yes. Here's the trade. In order to There are many of us that the current language where a veteran, it's on the veteran's shoulder to try to explain how military experience relates to the job. In order to make that go away by accepting the DAS approach, so it's literally show a DD Form 214, is it within 10 years? In order to get that level of simplicity and clarity, we felt it was reasonable, maybe not everything we'd want, but reasonable, that if you haven't been in the military for 20, 25 years, you probably should have some kind of work history that is understandable by civilians by that time. That really the 10-year limit is, by after 10 years, you should have, in addition to your service, civilian work that is understandable in terms of the HR process. Again, this is not a perfect compromise. I'm not going to tell you that it is. It was trying to make sure that we were relatively reasonable in terms of some time limit on aged experience, but at the same time, the most important point of this whole proposal takes out the escape clause, and I want to emphasize that. By taking away the discretion of agencies to implement this system or that system, my belief is it will be very clear, it will be very enforceable, and we're actually going to be surprised probably by how many people actually are using it, and that with that 10-year window, it's the way I look at it is you have 10 years to use that versus you're no longer a veteran after 10 years. It's just one more thing that we're trying to make sure that we emphasize the reintegration of veterans, because I don't want to be in a situation where it's a young vet getting back and a vet that's been back for 20, 25 years that actually can showcase a better work history, and we actually don't get the reintegrating vet that needs the job now. I don't want vet versus vet on that. And that was really what we were trying to get rid of. I'm not explaining it very clear, but that's what we're trying to do.
Okay. So here would be my recommendation and intent. First, as I have said before, I don't have any interest in going back and starting over again. When the bill came to us from the Senate, that was, you know, and we've got all that testimony in that. And so I appreciate the efforts that you tried not to do that. That's still my intent, and I don't know whether Senator Boquist would be wanting to start over. I don't believe that's his intent either. But I'd still like to introduce the bill as a committee bill now to keep an option open if there's some minor tweak or something we can do, but also to create a forum in which we can have a little broader conversation, not to re-invite all the testimony, but then based on that, clearly decide what the path is so that when we reach, whoever reaches 2017, hopefully it'll just be, that's it, and we don't have to go through that. So does that work for people?
Three of us have been on the Dev. I see Dev. We've been on this for quite a while, so
you might as well stay on it.
That's right. We may as well finish it out eventually. It's only taken 8-10 years.
Chair Lively, I think that's a great plan. I just want to make sure that people know that the language as it is right now is not what we had intended to have.
I understand. Okay. But we can have a little more conversation about that. We're going to have time.
We can amend that as we go.
So we'll have some time. So I appreciate that. So, any other comments or questions about this? Okay, so that's two of the three legislative concepts we have. The third is a placeholder bill dealing with emergency preparedness. And it is, would you remind us what the number of that is? And then maybe we can go ahead. Should we go ahead now maybe and deal with moving these for committee bills, if that's people are comfortable, and we'll get that off of the table.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the third committee bill is LC 172. It's posted on OLIS, and it is indeed a placeholder. It adds Department of State lands to a list of emergency liaisons at OEM, but I contacted them to tell them that it was not a real bill. It's meant to preserve the relating to clause relating to emergency preparedness.
Well, adoption of committee bills, too, doesn't mean you necessarily support it.
That's exactly right. All this does is get them to the bill, and then
unless
we'll decide.
Unless it's my bill.
then it's different.
Yes. Okay, I'll remember that, Representative Boone.
And it's Boone. Right, and it's not even assured that we would even hear it. I mean, that's yet to be decided once we get next with the other bills. So.
And, Mr. Chair, on the Senate side, there are two further placeholders that it might be of interest to this committee, the one that preserves the relating to clause relating to veterans.
Right.
And the other is, I believe you all got an email from Senator Boquist, there's a placeholder in case there's a need for a concurrent resolution for a memorial.
Right. Mm-hmm. Did get that too, so. Okay.
And Mr. Chair,
go ahead.
And while you're speaking of Senate bills, is
Senator Olson, have you got his in the mix?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, he has a particular memorial resolution for the Wright family.
Right.
That's it. The president's office, I believe, leadership on the Senate side has signed off on, so it's separate.
Okay.
It's a standalone concurrent resolution.
Just want to get it in there.
Yeah. Cool. So if people are comfortable, I'm going to open a work session for purposes of major introduction.
Chair Lively, I move the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. Legislative Council, or LC 57, dated December 2nd, 2015. LC 172, dated December 16th, 2015. And LC 176, dated January 14, 2016, dash one.
With a dash one, that's
with right. A dash with one. Okay.
Okay. Vice Chair Boone has moved that the legislative concepts as recited, LC 57 dated December 2nd, 2015, LC 172 dated December 16th, 2015, and LC 176 dated January 14th, 2016-1, be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Is there any objections? Is there any reason to vote?
Nope.
No. If there's agreement, we'll just have them introduced, and then we'll have our chance to.
There you go.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to close the work session. Now I'm going to reopen the informational meetings, and so we have a few organizations, agencies going to provide some discussions about potential priorities. And first on our list is Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And what I encourage the committee, and so the goal here is we're not looking that we're going to be able to do anything in the short session, but to start kind of the conversation about upcoming issues or where things are going for the next session. It would be nice if there is something we could do, but we're through legislating. So
good afternoon,
go right
Chair Lively, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I just want to give a quick update on our core programs and then get into some of the priorities as well. I will save the death by PowerPoint for my colleagues in the military department and move as quickly as I can. For 2015, as we turn into 2016 here in the calendar year, our home loan program, a program we've had since 1945 for 70-plus years now, was the largest, for 2015, was the largest, over $70 million in low-interest loans to veterans, the largest year in dollar amount since 1998, and the second largest in terms of number of units of loans. Now a growing loan portfolio of over $250 million, $260 million being serviced by the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and still very healthy and doing well as a program. In terms of aging veteran services, bringing that second veterans home online for Lebanon, now two-thirds of the way full with over 100 veterans and their family members, and opening up that last neighborhood to make sure that we get to full census there, and still maintaining census about 130 out of 147 beds in the Dallas facility as well for Rep. Huffman's district.
Sure. Rep. Huffman, go ahead.
I don't know if you've got this in your report, so I'm not right now, but just as I knew you were going to mention the Dalles, but for both homes, if you could maybe let us know if the department decided to change any safety policies or anything on the heels of what happened in the Dalles recently.
So, Chair Lively, Representative Huffman, we can definitely come back and do a larger brief on that as well, maybe during information days. In terms of veteran services, the core bread and butter of our work, 9,000-plus claims submitted in 2015. These are new claims in partnership with our county veteran service officers in the counties and our partnership with AOC. For 2014, federal VA impact now up almost $200 million extra just on that cold, hard cash of disability compensation and pension, $1.3 billion of federal VA dollars, a total of $2.5 when you add in that health care and education benefits as well. And off of that veteran services work, off of our results out of this last legislative session, and with your support, both on the system for all veterans in terms of the extra training officer and resources that we invested in, the extra $1 million that flowed down to the county veteran service officers, but also some investments in underserved veterans populations. Women veterans and our women veterans coordinator was one of the bills supported by the legislature and the governor. We now have our women veterans coordinator on board. Liz Esterbrook can raise her hand in the back. Many of you have met her, along with aging, along with aging veterans, with Mary Yeager as our aging veteran services director. Just today, further extension for rural veterans in terms of the highly rural transportation grant, $50,000 grant down to each of the highly rural counties with difficulty transporting their veterans both to medical appointments in the community as well as to the federal VA, and then working with Representative Evans and others on the Incarcerated Veterans Task Force. So we look forward to working with you on the individual bills that you have and the committee bills. In terms of priorities going forward as we build the governor's budget already this next summer for the long session in 2017, focusing on that health and mental health of our veterans, their education, and the economic opportunity for our veterans. And while we are serving all 330,000 veterans across the state, specific focus and outreach to most recent returning veterans, to Vietnam veterans that are our largest segment of the veterans population, almost 37% of our veterans, women veterans as that fastest rising demographic, and then also adding in our military and veteran families as outreach. And I would just note before, happy to take any questions, this Sunday, January 17th, is the 25th anniversary of the kickoff of combat operations for the Gulf War, from 1991, and we will have, given how quickly those combat operations were, we'll actually have the 25th anniversary of the end of that first Gulf War while you all are in legislative session in all likelihood in February. So either working with you all on either the House or the Senate side to see if we wanted to do a resolution recognizing that date, or working with the governor's office on a proclamation. But often an overlooked was one of the first wars where we ever had that televised from Storm and Norman to the Patriot Scud missiles, but 1991 to today, 25-year anniversary of the Gulf War. But happy to take any questions.
What questions do members have? Well, you won't always get off that easy, but thank you very much, Kevin.
Thank you.
Next, Oregon Military Department, Mr. Stuckey.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, I'm Dave Stuckey, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. Thank you for the opportunity today to discuss some of our near-term priorities. First off, I'd like to discuss just some of our legislative priorities here coming up for February 16. Most of them are in the Ways and Means arena. You may have heard me mention before in the past that we're looking for some general obligation bonds, or Q bonds, for our RTI building. We have a building over at the Western Oregon State Campus that has that quite frankly the Western Oregon would like to have, and we would like to move those operations out to Umatilla. And so we're working in concert with the university, and we also have an opportunity to develop some 7,500 acres and some land out in Umatilla proper. And so this is going to be an exciting opportunity for us. We're looking for and we've submitted a request for through our Ways and Means Public Safety to ask for some Q bonds. A couple other items that I would like to mention, just in wildland fire limitation. We fought fires this past summer. We spent money. We need limitation in order for Oregon Department of Forestry to reimburse us for that money. And so we're asking for $2.442 million in limitation. And then on the capital construction side, briefed this in the November policy days, and there's several projects, both the military museum as well as some armories in Portland, as well as in Medford, that we would like some limitation on to help spend some federal dollars and some other fund dollars and make the those armories look better and be modified. And so in a February 16 session, that's really where our focus is some tweaks in our limitation, and then also looking for some cue bonds. We obviously would look forward to any opportunities to help work with this committee on the policy and the policies that you mentioned here before coming up here. And so with that,
Mr. Stuckey, if you could, I'm not quite getting into the limitation. I'm not quite understanding what you're saying when you say limitation.
We're asking permission on limitation to accept money from someone else in order for us to spend it, Chair Lively.
Okay.
So, and that's in terms of Oregon Department of Forestry reimbursing us for the money that we spent.
We have already spent
yeah. largely for salary for okay. our firefighters this past summer. And then also in order to receive federal dollars to modify some of our armory complexes and other funds to modify the museum up at Camp Withicum, we need limitation to accept that money and then spend it, sir.
And so we already know that money is available.
That money's coming to us and it's there. And okay. so all these asks have been submitted in front of Public Safety Ways and Means, and we'll wait for the February session.
Sure. Very good. Thank you.
All right, sir. Moving on, the last two bullets I'd like to talk about. The disasters are behind us. The big fire season is behind us, but the work is now beginning. And so some exciting news when it came to FEMA and the federal government. Oftentimes that's not exciting, but in this particular case, they came up with a new program, and it's a mitigation program. And so this is not new. HMGP, or hazard mitigation, is not new as it applies to presidential declarations and floods, et cetera. What's new is that they now offer this program for post-fire season. Mm-hmm. And so that's very, very important to us. And so the Office of Emergency Management is going to help manage that. And so the sexy part's behind us. Now the work begins. And Office of Emergency Management has approximately $2.6 million in hazard mitigation federal dollars that they're going to work with the local jurisdictions that had the fire. This money has to be plowed back into those jurisdictions directly around those fires. And then a local match of about $800,000, so it's a 75-25 match, and then they'll be able to mitigate some of those concerns with fire. Some example projects are erosion controls, seeding and hydro seeding, basically stuff that once you burn this landscape, we don't want to see when the rains come, the dirt fall back onto into canals and roads, etc. So those are just some examples of these mitigation projects. It's pretty good from the standpoint that we're excited the federal government has looked at mitigation for fires. Mm-hmm. It's moving slowly. Federal government is just now starting to get its arms around this thing. We're hopeful that some of the first mitigation projects will be hitting the ground in the March timeframe. And just to review, the money's going back into Baker County, Grant, Josephine, and Douglas and Wallawa. So with that said, I'll move on to the presidential disaster declaration, which we haven't gotten yet, but we're very, very close. And so this is the disaster that was in December, 7/23. Office of Emergency Management, again, is hard at work. And so the process that we're in right now is a preliminary damage assessment. In fact, they briefed our director here today. And so although we had to preload the slides, what we're hopeful for is meeting the thresholds for a declaration. So the next step now, and we believe we've met those thresholds. FEMA thinks we've met those thresholds. We now must write a letter to the governor, or correction, to the President of the United States, signed by the governor, saying, please give us a presidential declaration. Our damages are somewhere in the neighborhood of $27 million. That's going to ebb and flow if, in fact, the disaster actually comes. But we're pretty excited and hopeful that we'll be able to get some federal dollars back in to help recover some of those areas that were damaged. And, again, those counties, those 13 counties that we believe are impacted and that have met this threshold in public assistance, because this is going to be public assistance dollars primarily, public assistance or public infrastructure, roads, publicly owned buildings, et cetera. It's going to be the counties of Clackamas, Clatsop, Columbia, Coos, Curry, Lane, Lincoln, Lynn, Multnomah, Polk, Tillamook, Washington, and Yamhill counties. And so we're hopeful. We will see what happens. Next step here is writing a letter and get the governor to sign it and send it off to the President of the United States and hope for a presidential declaration. And we think we've met that. We're We're also the office, the director of Office of Emergency Management, Andrew Phelps, is also looking at damage assessments on the individual side. It's a little bit more difficult, particularly when you're dealing with post insurance. So you have to account for that insurance actions, and so we're not actually as optimistic that we're going to get an individual assistance portion of this declaration, but most likely public assistance. And so with that, that's kind of our near-term priorities. We're recovering from fires. We're working on the winter storm of 7 to 23 December, and then at the same time, we have some ways and means actions here in the February session. So with that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Mr. Stuckey, I tried to listen to the 13 counties. Did you name Tillamook County, too?
Yes. Chair Lively, Representative Boone, absolutely. Tillamook County is one of those.
I thought you did because I know it was actually worse than Clatsop. But
reported damage is somewhere around $6.9 million at this point in time.
Really?
Representative Boone.
Thank you.
These PDAs, though, they quite frankly, what they do is they get out there, they look at the damages, they see that you meet the county threshold, and then they stop. That number could go up. We don't know yet. At this point in time, we just want to make the thresholds, and we want the President of the United States to know that we have damages out here. Please give us that declaration.
Yep. Thank you.
Other questions? Might you have a guess at how long the process might take till the point we would know that the President would sign, so then the process could start forward from that point?
Chair Lively, guess I believe is if the letter goes out here in the next week or so, it's going to take 4 weeks.
Okay. No, that's not
approximately. Mm-hmm. 4 weeks.
Okay. Very good. Any other questions?
Actually, for the federal government, that's
no,
fast.
That's right. That's what I thought.
That's lightning bolt.
Yeah. No, that's good.
Sir. Okay. And for FEMA, that can be
really lightning bolt.
That's on steroids.
That's right.
Okay. Very good. Thank
All right.
you.
Thank
Thanks
you.
Thanks a lot. You bet. Next up, we have Association of Oregon Counties, Andy Smith. Welcome, all of you.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Good afternoon, Chair Lively and Vice Chairs Esquivel and Boone. We thank you and all the committee for allowing us to be here today.
Chair.
I'm Rod Runyon from the Dalles, Oregon, part of Representative Huffman's district, chair of the Wasco County Board of Commissioners and co-chair of the AOC Veterans Committee. And with me today is Lincoln County Chair Commissioner Bill Hall, who is also a member of the AOC Veterans Committee. And with me, and he's also the first vice president of the AOC, and along with me also to my right here is Andrew Smith, who is our Veterans Policy Manager. So we have three main themes we want to share with the committee very briefly. First, we must continue to grow and maximize utilization of federal VA earned benefits, including compensation and pension, VA health care fund, and housing, which is a big item in the legislature. Secondly, in an era of limited general fund dollars, these are some of the wisest investments we can make. The return on investment is phenomenal, not even including the $1 billion of VA health care dollars spent in Oregon each year. $182 million of new compensation and pension federal dollars came into Oregon in 2014, and we don't have all the complete totals for 2015 as yet. The ROI for these new dollars based on the state general fund investment of $4.7 million returned $77 for every dollar invested. So for the 2015-2017 biennium, the growth will likely bring about $364 million of new VA dollars, which go directly to individual vets, their family members, and will turn over several times in our state economy. Third, earned benefits are a huge federal resource and are a direct economic development for all of Oregon's counties. The average monthly disability and compensation payments for the more than 67,000 Oregon veterans are over $19,000 per year and almost $1,600 per month. Mm. These federal dollars provide an invaluable tool for the legislature's help to reduce homelessness, and housing instability for veterans. So some of the basics of what we're doing at the AOC, quickly in my portion here. The mission of the AOC Veterans Committee is focused on outcomes. The AOC Veterans Committee works together as a collective voice for Oregon counties in an effort to provide the best possible services to our veterans, our service members, and their families. The committee works in many areas, but a core role is to support the critical work of the county veteran service officers. The CVSOs are the frontline asset. They can help unlock Byzantine VA systems so vets can obtain the disability, health care, and other benefits they have earned and that they deserve. So the range of benefits is large. Disability claims are often a very lengthy process. Commonplace appeals are confusing and overwhelming for individuals who don't understand the VA system. Specific training is needed to become a CVSO, and it takes 12 to 18 months on top of that on the job to become accredited by the federal government, and highlights the CVSO role as skilled advocates who must decipher a myriad of attorney-drawn documents in an ever-increasingly complex administrative environment. And at this point, I'd like to turn it over to the Lincoln County Chair, Bill Hall.
Thank you, Chair Runyon. And again, for the record, I am Bill Hall. And I want to go off script just for a minute and reassure the committee that Director Smith did not know that I was going to do this, and I was not compensated in any way for this, but I want to publicly thank him and his team. I imagine many of you have seen the shared services grid for state and county services, and so we work very closely with all kinds of state agencies at the county level, and in all depth of feeling, I've got to say, the Department of Veterans Affairs could and should be the model for the way every state department interacts with county government, and that is deeply, deeply appreciated. I also want to...
Don't look back.
Okay, okay. Is he blushing?
Well, is it every meeting?
Yes, yes. And we, yeah. I mean, not that the other interactions are not good, you know, although we do have our rough spots, but it's just an exemplary
partnership. We heard. You love vets and hate everybody else. We got it.
Okay, yeah. Well,
that is great,
you know,
to
and
hear.
I just want to underscore also how earned VA benefits are a huge economic driver in all our communities. It's a great source of income for our veterans, and, you know, housing is the issue of the moment. It's a great resource that allows these veterans to house themselves and their families. You know, Oregon is a national leader in the level of VA and federal expenditures that flow to veterans, yet still, we've only got 30% of our eligible veterans leveraging benefits. Just think about if we could even take that to 35 or 40%, what that could accomplish. And again, you already heard the numbers and that return on investment. Every dollar invested by the state producing a potential return on investment of $77. Where else can you get that much bang for the buck? I think you've already been provided this electronically, but I've just got this chart that shows the growth in compensation in pensions from 2007 to 2014 statewide. Let me give my own county, Lincoln County, as an example. In 2007, we had 1.8 FTE in our Veterans Office. Thanks to additional state money and additional commitment by our county budget committee, we now have two full-time VSOs in that office, gone from $12 million a year to more than $23 million a year. So almost doubled, a 94% increase, the same increase Wasco County saw in that time. And we're even kind of on the low end of that. You see a lot of counties with 130, 150% increases. So again, remember, and I think you're probably all already aware, this is not competitive money. This is money that these veterans and their families are entitled to, and it is an ongoing flow of dollars into our communities. I can't think of a better way to boost our economy and bring our veterans the benefits that they have earned with their service. So I thank you.
Thank you. And Andy, do you have any?
No. Vice Chair, members of the committee, this would be a resource. There's a lot of information in your packet, and just to say, this is, these are kind of the, I don't know what the right word is. This is the go-to manual. If you want to think about what's happening with numbers, what's the case to make for veterans, and the work of our frontline CVSOs to get federal dollars. This is information. If you could keep it in your top drawer. These are the numbers for 14. I would guess the numbers for 2015 will come sometime in the spring. But maybe one chart to highlight. You know, there's a lot there. But if you're a visual person, this is the historic growth of that compensation and disability benefit. You know, we could have done it a little differently, but the basic trend is up, and up each year. And you know, if we only sweeten the pot with additional investments for CVSOs, I think these increases could be even bigger, because it's largely a boots on the ground game. If you have people helping vets enroll and helping get their benefits, they will get their benefits. So if we had more capacity, I think we could certainly get more returns. So.
Thank you. Questions, comments from members of the committee? I want to thank both of you commissioners, especially for taking the time to come. We see Andy more often than we do you, but Andy for being here too. But I appreciate that. I have a question in both of your counties dealing with the homeless. Mm-hmm. I know in Lane County there's been a lot of different efforts, because there's been a pretty substantial problem with veterans homeless. And so are there specific county efforts that are going, because we're talking a lot in the legislature this time about housing and how we help create housing, not just specific to veterans, but are there specifics within both of your counties? I don't know what the level of the problem is or what else you may be doing.
Populations obviously are much smaller, yep, than in Lane County, and Commissioner Farr has kept us informed
on that.
The activities there, Chair Lively. I appreciate that. I serve on the Board of Community Action and Mid-Columbia Housing, and so we see this in the homeless count and whatnot. We don't have the numbers, I would say, but the percentage-wise, it's growing in the community of the Dalles, which is the largest community, half the population of our county. According to law enforcement, it's growing substantially. As far as what we can do, we're working on that right now. There's several efforts that are underway. It's a tough problem. We have also a member of Regional Solutions, and we have some money available for building some low-income and attainable housing. Mm-hmm. So working on further up the scale, but hopefully that'll generate some projects at the lower end as well. We also, besides the veterans housing, we're working on migrant housing as well. So we have a lot of housing projects on the table, but numbers, I don't have them at this
moment.
That's
all right. That's all right, Christine.
Yeah, in Lincoln County, we held our very first veterans stand down in January of last year, served about 75 veterans overall, and if I remember correctly, 32 of them met the federal definition of homeless
really?
Which was a really distressing number in a county overall with 45,000 people. We have been engaged in an effort for about 3 years now to get qualified for VASH vouchers. We have never been able to receive them. Our housing authority has never been invited to apply. We've just recently reached out to Senator Wyden's office for help in that. But I've got to say, one of my nightmares, I guess I shouldn't worry about problems that aren't here yet, because we've got enough real problems to worry about, is that we finally get vouchers and then we won't be able to use them, because Lincoln County's rental vacancy rate is now below 1%.
Really?
So that will be a challenge, but we'll keep working at it.
Anything else? Very good. Again, thank you very much, and thank you for the good work you're doing in the county.
Thanks.
We appreciate it. So next, Multnomah County Veterans Task Force, Sean Files.
Hello, Chair Lively and committee members. My name is Sean Files. I'm a policy advisor with Multnomah County Commissioner Diane McKeel's office, and she is a co-chair of the AOC Veterans Committee with Commissioner Runyon, and she's also a vice chair on the National Association of Counties Veterans and Military Service Committee, and she chairs a Multnomah County Veterans Task Force, which I'm here to present on today. We have submitted a year in review document, which was just completed, that I think you all have for reference. And to be brief, I'll give some quick highlights on it. This committee meets monthly. It's comprised of members of Multnomah County departments. Veterans don't just connect with the county through our Veterans Service Office. They come through Human Services. They come through the jail. They come through a variety. So this is a forum for for programs at Multnomah County to connect with each other and identify that network and what resources are available in collaborations. We've also expanded to local partners. So the VA, National Guard, ODVA is engaged. Local nonprofits as well. So it's a good collaboration at the county. Some more information is in the year in review document. A few highlights for our work plan from last year was identifying ways to support military children in school. And so we helped launch a pilot with the National Guard family team with a local school district. This coming year, we have a goal to continue to support that, hopefully develop a model that could be launched with other school districts about not just how to get those resources to schools as they identify kids that are in military families, but also working with the National Guard to educate families about how to advocate for their children as well in schools. We also have developed some documents to connect with businesses and educate them on assets that veterans bring to the employer, as well as incentives available for employers that hire veterans. And this coming year, in addition to the working with children in schools that are from military families, we're going to be working on collecting more data. So more information about veterans that access the Veterans Service Office, County Veterans Service Office in Multnomah County, so that we can do more strategic investment with resources and outreach based on that population. And then also seeking more information about veterans that are seeking jobs and connect with employers. And so that'll be from talking with businesses and then also working with the Oregon Employment Department to identify some of the data from veteran stand-down events. And so we can make some more strategic partnerships with that in the future. So I'm available for any questions, and thank you for the time.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was trying to look this up, and I'm not fast enough. But thank you for reporting on that. And I was wondering, I see Mark Sansusi's in the audience. And last session, we had a bill that didn't quite make it through as a bill, but we were promised by the Department of Ed that they would do it, you know, through them and regarding kids. And Mark, could you come up and
he's going to
thank sure. you because my
yeah he's on the list so that's
oh
great.
He is
no
okay.
That's fine that's all right since
anyway just that kind of cues me in although my right. memory exact is not he's the memory here so.
For the record, my name is Mark Sansusi. I'm the Department of Defense Regional Liaison for the Northwest six states. I drove down from Tacoma because I wanted to talk about a new one, and also talk about your question. Senate Bill 92 was about the military student identifier, and we were working with the ODE, but then what happened a couple months ago was President Obama signed the Every Student Succeeds Act, which includes that. So federal preemption, so that's...
Yeah.
Also, Senate Bill 97 we had here, I'm sorry, I don't want to step on. Senate Bill 97 was the other one we had in Oregon in 2015. It was on the Medicaid waivers for special needs families, which Representative Boone, I know you were involved with before it became a Senate bill. I can report that I'm really happy that the Oregon Department of Health put out an emergency rule effective January 1st, 2016, that all the counties are involved with to do exactly that, so we don't need to pursue Senate Bill 97 anymore. And what it helps do is all those military families with special needs folks who needed Medicaid waivers and had waiting lists years long, when they come back, they won't have to do that. So those were both taken care of those ways.
Great. Thank you. That's good news.
So if you would please, I'd like to hear, I'm trying to understand this concept about identifying children of military families. I mean, once they're identified, I'm trying to understand what you're attempting to do from a standpoint of services, or obviously they're in majority are probably in public schools. Mm-hmm. So I'm just trying to understand a little bit more about the end result once you get through that.
Yeah. Process. Chair and committee members, the goal is to perhaps do some training or information for school staff. One of the barriers has been children don't necessarily just identify with the counselor or the teacher. It could be a classified staff member. It could be anybody in the school that they have that connection with. So we're seeking to really connect with all staff at the school as possible and help them understand some of the issues that children face from military families. And then part of it is resources that are already available through National Guard, connecting with Veterans Service Office or other programs that they may need. And so to help the family, but also to keep those kids engaged. Sure. Because some of the barriers that we heard about, this was launched from a panel that we had with three spouses from military families in Oregon, as well as a superintendent from Gresham Barlow School District came and participated in our meeting, and we kind of launched it from that. That they have trouble with participating in sporting events, homework, a lot of these things that kids aren't able to because the families are kind of juggling around.
Okay.
And so that's one of the goals. Sure. is so that they understand here's some of the barriers and maybe here's some ways to work with these kids when maybe a parent isn't able to be engaged as other families where they don't have a parent that's deployed.
Good. Any other questions or comments?
That's great.
Yeah, that is great.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much for taking the time. Sure. So, Mark, did you have... Now it's your turn. Department of Defense. Yes, there it is.
Yes, Mark Sansusi back again, the DOD guy. What I thought I would talk about today for your consideration, maybe it's too late for this short session, maybe next year, but 2015 we have a new issue. In meeting materials, I sent testimony, but I don't want to read that. I sent a one-pager and a best practice paper, Department of Defense issue. We're calling family advocacy, but it's really about child abuse and neglect reporting. 70% of military families live off an installation on an active duty base. I know there's not much of that in Oregon, but there are like 20,000 Reserve Guard people. There are also 1,500 active duty members, spouses, total dependents. Unfortunately, child abuse happens. The Department of Defense Family Advocacy people in the Pentagon report that in what they know of the reporting, child abuse reporting has gone up. Child abuse allegations have gone up 10% in the last year within the Department of Defense for military families. So what the issue is about is DOD is required under Title 10 to coordinate with civilian child welfare agencies, but it's been by memorandums of understanding in the states, which tend to be sometimes inconsistent between a state agency, a military installation, and a county. And so what we've been doing is going out and advocating for language in statute, which would be consistent statewide, to help do that. We did pass it in Washington State this past year, first in the nation. We passed it in South Carolina. I have a bill in work right now in Idaho, and I'm working with the Alaska people up there. And what we found is, to use Washington as an example, there were three MOUs statewide. One was with the Navy, one was with JBLM, one was with Fairchild, and when you looked at them, they were inconsistent. And so what was happening is, a family that does not live on an installation, if they have an allegation of abuse or neglect, the authorities would not necessarily think to ask, are you military? And we want that's in state law so that they ask the question and the family advocacy program and counselors and experts on an installation or within the service can help that family with those issues. Plus, we want the chain of command to know also, and thereby Staff Sergeant Snuffy isn't necessarily slipping through the cracks out there and somewhere where he or she is in the military, but it's not reported. So just to get consistency, and in Washington State, essentially no fiscal note, we pass it. It's about six lines added into statute in the appropriate place. And I'm not here as any reflection on an Oregon child support agency. No known issues here. That's not why I'm here. But just to talk about that relatively easy fix for consistent language and we're working it, and we have a number of my colleagues in the other states have a number of bills doing the same thing.
Okay. People have questions? Yes, Representative Boone, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark, could you send us the bill or the template?
My testimony.
Oh,
and meeting materials. I took the liberty of putting the links
in there.
Okay,
to
perfect.
The bill digest and the okay. session law there, and I can resend it certainly to Cheyenne if
no,
you'd
I'll
like.
No, I'll just but look it up if it's in OLS.
Right. So. We passed in South Carolina and Washington last year, and again, we have some good momentum in some other states.
Other states. Very good. Any other questions? Thank you for bringing that to our
attention. Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you.
You bet. So that's all of our the priorities we're talking about. So we're down to the point where we're going to preview any member concepts that could be referred to our committee. And I'm aware that Representative Paul Evans has one. I don't know if any other members do, but this is your chance to.
I just have something I want to discuss with the good of the order, I think.
Yeah, and we'll talk about those too. So, Paul, you want to just talk a little bit about your.
Yes, sir. I have a one-pager that I think you may have, but just in case, it's there. The bill is all the things that have been talked about to help veterans sometimes need a little more money than we have. And the bill before you is what I believe and what so far has appeared to be a measure that folks that have traditionally not been as excited about such an attempt can buy into. It's a 3% set aside of lottery revenues for veterans outreach and veterans programming. The idea is it would be 3% of the veterans lottery revenue starting July 1, 2017 if it's approved by the voters. So the bill in front of you is actually a referral to the voters. If the voters approve it, it's 3% of the lottery for from 2017 to 2050. It would scale down to 2% at 2050 to 2075, and then at 2075 it would be established a permanent rate of 1%. And the reason for that is, quite frankly, that since 1973, the transformation of the all-volunteer force, it reflects the need to, A, assist the five generations of veterans we have right now, but over time, adjust to population demographics because it's an all-volunteer force. It also has something that most other lottery options do not have, but I think is a fair compromise. Under a 3/5 vote, the legislature can reduce the 3% or 2%, whatever it may be, down to 1% for one biennium if needed, but putting a floor of 1% so that 1% is never gone below. The ballot measure, I'm learning as we go, but this bill in front of you is the referral. There'll also be a statutory companion that goes with it as far as implementation. Once the chair and the committee appear to be moving the bill, Legislative Council assures me they will move that bill very, very swiftly. And in that statutory language, what I'm anticipating is an express prohibition for veterans services to be to try a double dip of lottery revenues. And the reason for that is there has been some concern in the past that if there are additional resources, education and natural resources needs access to those monies. And quite frankly, with the 3% set aside, that would provide about a $38.2 billion for this biennium. So $19-ish million a year to use for partnerships, use for outreach, use for leveraging federal dollars to try to capture hopefully the bulk of what we estimate to be somewhere near $4 billion that we're currently leaving on the table every year. I think it's a fair compromise. I think both inside and outside the building will have strong support. I ask for your support. And it's passing around if you're interested.
You got us all. Got everybody. So Representative Escobar.
This kind of fits in a little situation I had in Southern Oregon where I had an individual write me a little note, and he was a veteran, and he was 79 years old. Told me that he'd went to Costco to get some food, and of course his debit card didn't have enough money in it. Then he went home to get some money from the wife, and she said, "We don't have any more," so he ended up hawking one of his guns to get his groceries instead of getting his brother to eat. So we took a collection up for him. I set up a little fund for him and got some money for him so he could get his gun back out, and plus he could have some money, extra money for groceries. But, you know, this fellow's a veteran, and he'd lost his house. It had been foreclosed upon. That's a shame. That's a crime. An 80-year-old man now doesn't have a house, doesn't have enough money to get by with, and yet I look at some of the ways we spend money, not only in this state, but the federal government and locally. We need to look at our priorities, because those veterans, they've paid the ultimate price. So hopefully we can work on that in the future. And I wish that were more money.
Any other questions for Representative Evans on this particular concept? I think everybody's signed on to it, so we'll see if we can assist in getting it moved, at least from our committee out and with an endorsement, if that's what people agree to. But we'll have a hearing on it, obviously, during the regular session.
It's not a committee bill, but I'll call it that if you want. It's
whatever, yeah.
Whatever it takes to move it.
Well, we've already committed to three committee bills, and so
we're allowed three committee bills.
Yeah.
Well, only three. I thought it was five.
I thought it was five.
Yeah. Really? Not five.
Yeah, I always said it was five.
It's three. It's three.
Two for each member. Maybe that's.
Yeah, two for each member. That was three committee bills.
Maybe.
Well, I don't know.
I thought it was two for each member, five committee bills. I think we better check on that one.
Well, we're almost out of time.
Okay.
But I can certainly follow up. Thank
you. Okay. In fact, we are. In fact, Tuesday. Yeah, you got to be in here by yourself.
That's right.
So any other legislative concepts that members are introducing that might come to this committee?
If everybody signs on, it is a committee.
It is, yeah.
Okay. And so I know a couple members had talked about maybe some information that we'd like to talk about be shared during the session. So, Representative, I'll let you first.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. We had an individual that I know that's very specific, and he's into emergency services, and he made quite a point with me in the aspect that we have government that has this set up to react this way. But he said, "What steps have we taken for the individual to take care of themselves for the first 7 to 14 days? What education process have we done or completed or suggested?" That's what it was. It was just a big blank of nothing at this point. We aren't reaching out to people. We aren't telling them to prepare for it. I mean, What programs do we have in place to let them know that in case of an emergency, you should have 7 days of food and water? Have you seen anything in our communities? Anyone seen anything? You have that over there?
Yeah, in spades. Yeah, okay. Along the coast.
See, we don't have that at all in my community.
Oh. And we have it through our county.
But I meant to the citizens.
Yes. Yeah. Huge outreach program.
Okay. See, we don't have that in my county. I don't know if they have in your county or.
Maybe you're not going to have a disaster.
Well, we probably won't.
Lucky
you know, not. we're in the banana belt of Oregon anyway.
That's right.
But I don't know if they have in yours, Mr. Chair.
They have. But the part of the when you're asking the question, part of it is how effective have we been getting the information out, regardless of the fact that we have it. So I think it's an interesting conversation, and you're right. That's another example where there's differences in Oregon, and some especially on the coast where mm-hmm. you're more familiar with how quick this is. But that doesn't mean that there shouldn't be across the state some awareness in that. And there's bound to be small counties and or communities that have no resources in which to address this probably. So
yeah. So I'd like to hear what he has to say about. And he's got specific lists and everything of what people should have in case of disasters.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Esquivel, did you say I'd missed it in your district?
Yes.
He's from your district? Okay.
Well, no, he's in Representative Buckley's district.
Okay. Well, you know, Mr. Chair, we in Energy and Environment Committee, we often have an informational hearing, using an update, what's happening along the coast mm-hmm. in programs, like especially Oregon State University, NEMRAC, things like that. Just to update people, and if we've done something legislatively in a sector, we'll have that person come back and, you know, not an official report, but just an update in that sense. And that would be really good to do and invite some people from that sector, as well as this guy, to
let us know what's happening in our state, you know, because we could probably cover the coast with a couple of people, you know.
Well, see, the thing that he has run into, he spoke to the people in our county, and our county said, well, we've got it handled. Well, how can you have it handled when no one knows what they're supposed to be doing? And there's been no outreach in my county.
Okay. May I ask another question?
Certainly.
Make a suggestion. Andrew Phelps, our OEM director, gets around, I'll tell you, and maybe he could help us, you know, put together something for the
task force session.
No,
an Evans force.
And I heard Rep. Escobar volunteered to be.
No, Rep. Escobar didn't volunteer.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Can I request a nod from Andrew, and then we can read it into the record instead of him having to come up? I'm just curious, based on this, do we have public service announcements that the agency has produced and they're out to radio and TV stations along those lines? Would you mind if he comes up? And
can't nod on that one.
I realized that after.
Nice try for a nod, but
yes, no, come on ahead.
Yeah. And Mr. Chairman of the committee, it is, I have confirmed, it is three.
If enough of you doubt me,
I'll have
better
response.
Somebody's
changed on us.
Yeah, somebody.
We used to have five.
I assure you that.
Sorry.
Okay. Chair Lively, members of the committee, Representative Escobar. Emergency preparedness messaging is really the cornerstone of a successful emergency management program. It disheartens me a little bit that the messaging isn't making it to your ears. My hope is that it's making it to the ears of your community. We've got a pretty robust public education information sharing program. Through formal and informal media channels. We certainly work well with media outlets along the coast, not just the Portland metro area. We also rely pretty heavily on social media, so Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, to get messaging out about all kinds of things that folks can be doing to prepare. One of the takeaways from the resilience report was that shift in messaging from 3 days of preparedness to 14 days of preparedness. So we're modifying a lot of our publications and our messaging to specify the 14-day length of time for preparedness at a minimum recommendation. Certainly something we want to make sure that all of our local emergency managers, who are really that touchstone or that point of contact we have with our local communities, also have access to that messaging. So I'll certainly reach out to your emergency manager in your county and make sure that...
I don't even know who that is.
Which county, sir?
Jackson.
I believe that's Sarah Rubricht.
Wouldn't know.
Okay. We'll make sure
she
gets in touch.
Mr. Chair.
Sure.
How are you getting this out? Are you going via TV? Are you going radio? I mean, you said social media, but a lot of people that don't get on your Facebook page, no offense. But.
None taken, sir. We do traditional media advertising as well, with public service announcements via radio channels and television channels. A lot of that also happens locally. I do think the message is getting out there. We had over 500,000 people sign up and participate in the Great Oregon Shakeout across the state of Oregon. So that's a pretty significant percentage of our population who participated in that event, and that was strictly through public messaging campaigns, internet posts, social media outreach, and then through traditional media sources.
They did it through social mostly.
And then also just through public forums. One of our most requested speakers is Althea Rizzo. She's our geological hazards coordinator, and she spends a majority of her time traveling across the state talking about not just the tsunami hazard, but also the earthquake hazard, which is hazard really border to border here in Oregon. And I don't know how many thousands of people she addresses in public forums each year, but she's always willing to come and chat to folks about emergency preparedness and the things that folks can do, and exactly the types of things that your constituent mentions, the types of things that they need in your emergency kit. And it's more than just stuff. It's having access to information and knowing what to do during an emergency, getting a little bit of training, first aid, CPR training, things of that nature. So we've expanded the messaging, I think, beyond just having a 2-week supply of water and non-perishable foods, but some of those less tangible things, having access to information, knowing where to get information, encouraging folks to get their amateur radio license. Here at the Office of Emergency Management, we had six of my staff, myself included, go through the amateur radio licensing process this past fall. So that's also part of the comprehensive message that we're trying to push out to folks.
Might add, Mr. Chair, you can buy a very nice handheld shortwave radio, ham radio, that you can hold. you need a license. It's eight. What is it? Eight megawatts or whatever? What did they call it? Eight. I don't know what they call it.
I barely passed my licensing
I thought you were licensed.
Just each by.
Know all of them.
Obviously, they didn't ask that question.
The technology has come a long way, sir. There's an outfit up in Tigard.
That's what it is.
Yeah. And they sell an amateur radio, ham radio, for $25. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, the ones I got were like $50, $60, but they're pretty.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Rep. Esquivel, I'm sure you voted for one of my bills last session. House Bill 2270, I know. We will be getting a resilience policy advisor in the governor's office soon. And
we voted for that.
Sorry?
We voted for that.
Yes, we did. And the other thing I wanted to say is that we're going to be, I don't know how to say this because there is somebody in that position already, but you could duke it out with Representative Clem and get appointed to the OSPAC, which is the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisor Council, and hear every couple months what's happening. And you could also join your local CERT team and become a voice, you know, for this. I'm just trying to help you out here.
So, Representative Caluso.
Well, I was going to change the subject. Are we ready to do that?
Okay, I just wanted to say on that particular subject.
Let's talk about that.
I think what might be helpful, and I appreciate the information you provided about the outreach, what might be helpful in this conversation, because I know some have worked at this longer than others, but it might be helpful to hear from a couple counties specifically. And what I'd like to hear, and I appreciate the information, is some examples of how it's getting down to the citizens and what they're doing about it. Because I know we have a lot of going on in my county, but I'm not clear yet. Has anybody, once they've listened to that, have they done anything? So are the citizens really preparing, or are they?
There you go.
I guess so. That's kind of if we're going to have this
kind
conversation.
Of with it.
Just as an aside, I just heard that Oregon Public Broadcasting is being nominated for the WISP Award, which for excellence for reporting on resilience and emergency preparedness. And they talk about it. Tom Bonzi's been one of the things. So you could start listening to OPB and learn everything you need to know.
You are pushing him.
some of the time they get their story ideas from what happens in committee.
Sure.
Yes,
so,
they do.
That's
yes.
true.
Well, what I would suggest, what I'm going to do, I'm going to go around my neighborhood and I'm going to ask 10 people if they've ever heard of anything.
It's interesting. It's going to be interesting
It'll
to see.
It'll be interesting to see how many out of those 10 people say yes, they've heard something.
And that is exactly what the programs that work best in communities are: is a door-to-door thing. You can do it while you're campaigning. You know, you can just let them know, put out a piece that tells.
Okay,
them
wait a minute. I think I stepped over the edge.
Not supposed to mention those words.
That's right,
Representative Caluso.
If I could get the indulgence of our committee for about five more minutes, I would like to invite Elizabeth Estabrook up to the. I know I'm taking you by surprise up here, with your permission, Director Smith. I just want to acknowledge, again, everybody up here for your support in bringing on our Women's Veterans Coordinator. I think it's just I am still thrilled about it. Elizabeth did testify before us on that bill, but I just would like you to kind of refresh the memory of all of us, your background, what brought you here, and you can be brief.
Okay. I was Army from 1977 to 1980. I joined, all right, I went into basic training. I was the first co-ed women's group after WAC was dismantled. And that was kind of a big deal. And I was also the first woman to serve in the company, in 66 Maintenance Company in Kitzingen, Germany. I was the only woman in that company for 6 months. And so I sort of had... Army by baptism by fire, or something like that. But
for the record, could you just introduce your name? Give your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes,
that's all right.
Elizabeth Estabrooks.
Thank you.
Oregon Women Veterans Coordinator. So I sort of did not acknowledge that I was a veteran for all those years, and I didn't think of myself as a veteran. I was told clearly throughout my military career or history, my 3 years, that I wasn't military, that women weren't real soldiers. And then what followed was sort of a public acknowledgement of that through messages that show males as veterans. And so I sort of separated from that for a long time. And then I turned 40 and my knees started hurting more. And I had been injured in the Army and actually in basic training. And so I was told by a veterans representative at an employment office that I needed to apply for a disability, which I immediately said I couldn't because I wasn't a real veteran. And so I did. And that, as a result of getting that disability, I began to see myself as a real veteran. And over the years, I've done a lot of social service work, primarily focused on women and personal violence, domestic violence, sexual assault, and gender-specific services to women and girls throughout Oregon. And that just drove me further into to graduate school. And in graduate school, I decided to focus on women veterans, and I began research. So the 2 years that I was at Columbia, I just researched and wrote on women veterans and military sexual trauma and assault in particular. So my goal was to get a job exactly like this when I graduated, and I've been waiting, and here I am. So thank you. It's a privilege and an honor, and I truly believe that this is going to make a tremendous difference for women veterans in Oregon, both in acknowledging themselves as veterans. I see that there are 28,000 women veterans in Oregon, and I'm always wondering how many there actually are. We know there are 28,000, but really, how many women veterans are there in this state? So how many are homeless? How many commit suicide? How many are going through a lot of the issues and problems that veterans have that we are missing? And I look forward to increasing the number from 28,000 to that truer number.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Sure. Well, I don't know if you can ask.
We have those 50 questions that we
have. Since she wasn't expecting to be up here, I just...
Can you or would you send your thesis or whatever you wrote on? Is that possible?
Sure. We didn't. It was a master's of social work program, and Columbia University does not, in their School of Social Work, you don't write a thesis. We do capstone project. But I do have some papers that I wrote.
I'd love to read them.
I would be happy to send. And I had a paper on advocacy and military sexual assault published in the Columbia Social Work Review. So
wow.
I'll send that as well.
I'd love to read it. Thank you.
All right.
You. Yeah.
You're welcome.
Thank you again, and welcome. We look forward to working with you and supporting you.
Thank you. And again, if any of you would like to see me, just let me know.
Thank you. Thanks.
Representative Boone, did you have a topic you wanted to make sure we heard some information on?
You know, and just kind of morphs into it. Thank you.
Yeah.
I remember the project that's going on in the old nursing home here in Salem for vets. A drop-in center and a residential and everything. I was wondering if we could at some point get an update on how that's going. And it's for men, I know, but and then what other things, now that you're here, Liz, what's going to happen for homeless women vets? And so there's somebody else who was working on that, and I think up in my area, or it was this, you know, I just remember little clips of things that people have said, and I just wondered what if we could find out that's what's happening around the state, you know, if there are individual counties or, you know, veteran service officers somewhere else are saying, yeah, we're starting a program for women here, so we can know what's happening statewide in that. Thank you. And aren't you lucky you get to work with Cameron?
Yes.
And yes.
And did you have anything about resiliency or emergency preparedness also?
Well, I just heard that there was, somebody asked me from the OSPAC meeting on Tuesday what was coming up, and I said, to the best of my knowledge, and we had not had any of our, during this time, we don't get to see people's LCs unless they show them to us. So all I've seen or heard of is in my own caucus in the House, one of four caucuses. So I know I wrote down what everybody was doing in the House Democrats caucus, but I don't know what everybody else is in the building. So I didn't know, and I did tell them, though, where all I knew was the veterans or the resilience policy advisor position would be hired soon, and hoping it gets done before the end of the month. somebody asked me today if they'd been hired yet, and I said, I don't know. I don't know. They're in the process. I know that. And so that will then, I hope, that their one of their first tasks will be to do what Senate Bill 808 would have done. Senator Mona Sanderson and I had that bill, and that was basically the Oregon Resilience Plan 2, which is the people part of that, and that's getting right down to dealing with mass displacement and mental and physical health issues and the usual things when you have a disaster, right down to water systems that would morph into it. How do you house, clothe, feed, and take care of these people who have been displaced or injured or whatever? And then a lot of the social trauma or psychological trauma that will accompany it. So that, and what we're hoping is that we could reignite that task force from Senate Bill 33, which did the resilience plan. A lot of those people were just disgruntled that it ended, and it did end at a point, and they gave their report. But the Oregon Resilience Plan is a work in progress. It's going to happen over the next few years. You know, hopefully the thing won't happen, so we can build it out and have it there, as Representative Esquivel, I almost said Senator, Representative.
Used to be. I've gone to the good side.
I know. That's where I think it is. Then you can take that, their work, you know, and it will be at the community level, and that's what we're hoping to do. There have been a lot of requests for additional members of that position, or those positions in that task force, because they were kind of named as to who, that not people named but positions. And then there are also the usual, you know, extra person at large or whatever. I don't know where that came from, but so there will be legislative members positions, and you know, it can be as big as the governor's person wants it to be. So, and that's all happening without legislation at this point. So maybe when they get going, they can. And that was really nice, because that bill, at the very last minute, did not go forward, even though it had lots of support. So I was very happy to hear that. I was, you know, very happy to hear that.
Mr. Chair, I look at this like, if we have this catastrophic event where the earthquake happens, and you're clear almost to the middle of the state, you have problems, that's going to overwhelm anyone. I mean, you're talking a couple million people here, and so therefore those individuals must be educated, and they must be prepared to fend for themselves for at least 7 to 14 days. Have to be, because the government does not have a response team that can take care of 2 million people. And I see Dave sat there shaking his head, and it's true. You know, it's just a fact of life. But we need to get to these people so they understand what they need to do and how they need to prepare. I mean, it doesn't take that much. Oh.
Okay. Representative Evans.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, if I could just for 1 minute, I want to publicly commend and acknowledge the hard work that's going on between Department of Corrections, ODVA, especially all the folks that have made the Incarcerated Veterans Task Force functional.
Functional.
It's rolling. The chair is a good and focused taskmaster in the best sense of the term. And we've already identified 3 or 4 policy options that I think we can return back to the legislature for clarity on. And I think there's probably 3 or 4 more that we're going to be exploring. But I just wanted you to know that the task force is up, it's running, it's doing good work, and it's been meaningful conversations.
Great. Anything else? Well, while we'll have limited time in a short session, we will have some time if there's some issues that you want to make, we get on the agenda so we can be start getting prepared for people to address them in 2017. But otherwise, we will see you all February 1st, if not before.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah,
that,
Mr. Chair.
Right, thank you very much.
Thank you. Good meeting. Well, and the other thing is.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good meeting. Well, and the other thing.